The recording. I'm getting much better about that. I haven't actually forgotten once to set the recording, so this is pretty cool. So because we've been doing everything virtually, we're ahead of schedule, and that means we get to look at this lab that we don't normally get to do, which is an oxidation reduction scheme. And there's a number of reasons that I like this lab. It gets to introduce some oxidations and some reductions. We get to look at oxidizing reagents, reducing reagents, and there's just a number of different things in this lab that are kind of nice to look at this point in the semester too, as we're getting into the SN1, SN2, E1, E2 reactions and really getting into the thick of it. There's some topics that are a little bit more difficult that have to do with sterics and looking at how sterics affect certain chemical reactions. And this lab allows us to investigate that and see how sterics can actually affect things a little bit as well. So it's kind of a fun lab from that standpoint. And also within the oxidations, there are different varying oxidation techniques. And we traditionally have done a more green sort of oxidation technique. It doesn't give as high a yield, but we can compare and contrast the two oxidation techniques a little bit between these two different labs. Pavia had in the old version of Pavia, there was one oxidation scheme that they used, sodium hypochlorite, they used bleach. And in the new version, they use a reagent that's called pyridinium chlorochromate. And the pyridinium chlorochromate does work a lot better. It gives a much higher yield in terms of the oxidation, but it's not green at all. And the chromium is highly carcinogenic, particularly the chromium 6 that we need to use in order to do the oxidation. So we'll compare some of those things. So that's the idea. So let's sort of jump into it and look at the overall reaction and what's going on here. We start off with borneol. And borneol is a bicyclic ring system. And it's got a hydroxyl group that is in the downwards orientation. It has methyl groups at the top of this molecule and at the side of the molecule. And we tend to use it in its racemic form. So it has a number of different stereocenters within this molecule. We've got the stereocenter here, here, and here. And we use it as racemic. So we use it plus minus borneol. And just to get a sense of what this molecule looks like when you draw it flat, if we draw the molecule flat, what we do is we take and make these two groups come out towards you. And then there's the methyl that comes across them like that. At one of these carbons, we can choose the one out here. We have the methyl group that extends off of that guy. And then if we twist that around appropriately, then there is a downwards hydroxyl group. And so that is the plus minus borneol drawn in a two-dimensional sense. Okay, from that, what we do is we take and do an oxidation. So this is the symbol for oxidation, where we put an oxygen into concentration brackets, the way that we would draw concentration, but that's a shorthand symbol for oxidation. So we oxidize this molecule. And when we oxidize it, we oxidize the hydroxyl group up to a ketone. And then we go through and we do a reduction and we reduce it using sodium borohydride. And after doing the reduction, we wind up getting two products that come out of this. One of them is getting the borneol back, but the other one is getting isoborneol. So we can get the borneol back. And the other product, as I said, is isoborneol, where the hydroxyl group is up. And we look at the ratios of borneol to isoborneol that occur within this reduction. So we get borneol and isoborneol. And in that reduction, what's happening is the hydrogen, the hydride that is doing the reducing, can come either from the bottom face, or the hydride can approach from the top face. And we call the top face, we call this exo, and the bottom face, we call this endo. And the exo approach leads to the borneol. So this one comes from the exo approach. The endo leads to the isoborneol. And part of what happens is we're looking at the sterics of what these methyl groups do for the top approach and how they cut down the top approach in this molecule, leading to a higher percentage of the isoborneol in the endo approach. So the major one is over here, and we look at the percentages that we get out of that and try to understand how the sterics are affecting this chemical reaction. And so it's got a number of different kind of cool mechanisms to look at from the standpoint of the oxidation and the reduction and learning some new reagents. So that's kind of where we're at. Okay, everybody with me so far? Got my tea. It was actually hotter than I thought it was. All right, so to start this off, we're going to just work on the oxidation step today. We're not going to work on the reduction step today. We'll pick up the reduction step next Monday, because I think we got enough to look at the oxidation in terms of this and how this whole reaction kind of goes together. So let's focus on that oxidation part and look at a couple of different oxidizing agents. Normally within oxidations, in the way that an oxidation works for organic molecules, is we have an alcohol that we want to oxidize. And I'm gonna leave a hydrogen that is out here on this carbon. We usually convert that oxygen into some metal bond. So we take a metal of some sort. Usually this is a metal ion of some sort. And we bind the oxygen to that metal. And then there's some base that comes in and pulls the proton, kicking the electrons in to make the double bond and giving the electrons to the metal. So what winds up happening is the metal winds up being reduced while the organic component is oxidized. And so we end up with the metal with a lone pair of electrons now. And this guy is reduced. And this guy is oxidized. That's the general scheme for an oxidation and how an oxidation works is they're always mediated by some metal that is accepting the electrons. And one of those reagents is chromic acid. So there's a reagent that's called Jones reagent. And Jones reagent is a chromic acid oxidation. It's made with sulfuric acid, H2SO4, and CrO3. And combined, these two things combined make chromic acid. So the chromic acid, I believe, is this guy. And if we look at the oxidation state of that chromium, the oxidation state of that chromium is a +6 oxidation state. chromium in a plus six oxidation state is orange in color. And so this reagent is an orange sort of reagent. That does not, there we go. So we can do some highlight here. So this guy is orange in color in the plus six oxidation state. And, oh God, my dogs are so barky. And when we use this as an oxidizing agent, it does exactly what I was mentioning before, that what we get is the alcohol bound to that chromium. And then some base in solution that we throw in here plucks the proton, pushing electrons in and kicking electrons onto the chromium so that we get the oxidation occurring. We get the base and the proton, and we get a chromium, which now is in a lower oxidation state, has been reduced. And generally the fate of the chromium, and I don't exactly know the entire process, but the chromium winds up going down to a plus three oxidation state eventually. And the plus three oxidation state is green in color. And so the color change can tell you when the oxidation has occurred and when the oxidation is complete because of the way that the chromium changes in its color from the plus six state to the plus three state. The entire reaction changes color as the reaction proceeds, goes from that bright orange color down to a green color, and it's a pretty vibrant, bright green color. The problem with chromium is that it's extremely carcinogenic. So chromium in its plus six state is a known carcinogen. And there have been cases where there have been industrial processes that have liberated chromium into the water sources within their communities where people use a lot of well water. And that well water has caused cancer blooms in certain areas, and they were able to definitively prove that it was the chromium, the plus six chromium, the hexavalent chromium, that was actually causing those cancer blooms. So we know that hexavalent chromium is extremely carcinogenic. And I'm sorry, my dogs are so distracting this morning. This is gonna be really challenging if I can't get them to shut up. And so I don't really want to use the chromium, although it's kind of cool to look at. And rather than using Jones reagent is like a sledgehammer. It is an extremely strong oxidizing agent, and it oxidizes all different types of alcohols. It oxidizes aldehydes, it oxidizes everything. It's a pretty amazing reagent. But one way to attenuate it, to make it slightly less strong, is to get rid of the strong acid. So instead of using sulfuric acid, H2SO4, they've developed another reagent that is called PCC, pyridinium chlorochromate. So pyridinium chlorochromate is a slightly more selective reagent than is the Jones reagent, and it doesn't use quite as strong acid. So this is called pyridinium chlorochromate. And what we do is we take pyridine, which is
an aromatic. Jason, can you switch it, the screen, to your iPad?
It was on iPad, wasn't it?
It was earlier, but now it's not.
Okay, thank you, Dina.
No problem.
It must have been. Yeah, it's telling me I need to reboot it. It must have been that phone call that came in that interrupted it, and it didn't switch back. Okay, so we're looking at pyridinium chlorochromate. Did you guys get the rest of this? I'm sorry, I didn't know if that, I don't know where it cut off at. Did we see this slide already or see the entire drawing there? So this was the Jones reagent, just looking at the Jones reagent and the oxidation that the Jones reagent does. and going from the chromium that is in the plus six oxidation state. And as that chromium does the oxidation, it reduces down to a plus three state and goes down into a green color for that metal. And so what we were going to do was look at pyridinium chlorochromate and how this reagent is formed. So what we do is we take pyridine, which is an aromatic amine. We add to it HCl, and we add to it the chromate. And what we wind up getting is a reagent that is called pyridinium chlorochromate. The amine serves as a base, and it makes the pyridinium ion. And the HCl and the chromium form this guy, which is the chromate or the chlorochromate. And that has a negative charge on it. So this together is the active reagent, pyridinium chlorochromate, and we call it PCC. So this reagent is just frequently referred to as PCC. PCC, when you look at the chromic acid, this chromic acid is a strong acid in and of itself, made with H2SO4, and the strong acidic nature of it allows it to oxidize many different types of functional groups. And so this guy's strong acid. And you can see that strong acid here in that if we look at the chromium and the hydroxyl group, this looks almost like a carboxylic acid, except the chromium is there instead of a carbon. And it is, it's very much like a carboxylic acid in the strength of that that strong acidic group there, actually stronger than a carboxylic acid. But the pyridinium chlorochromate has no protons. And because it has no protons, it's not acidic in the same way that that the chromic acid is acidic. And this makes it a much more mild reagent and allows it to do certain types of oxidations, or I should say, inhibits certain types of oxidations that the chromic acid would undergo. It is still a hexavalent chromium, so it is still chromium in its 6+ state. It is still carcinogenic, as all get out. And because of that, it makes me concerned in its use, because I like not to have you guys work with as strong carcinogens. Excuse me for a second. Let me go see. My dogs are just killing me. Hang on one second. Let me see what I can do here. We're gonna see if that's better. It's gonna be better for me. It's not better for the ducks, but they'll live. All right. Let's see if my brain can actually work now. So with this pyridinium chlorochromate, it still functions in the same way. The mechanism for this, in terms of having the alcohol and the way that this reaction works, is that the alcohol winds up attached to the chromium, and the chloride becomes a leaving group. So the chloride is there to serve as a leaving group, allowing, first off, the attack of the alcohol onto the chromium, and once we attack the chromium, electrons shift up, so we're going to have a bunch of things connected to this chromium. We get an O minus. We have another O minus that is hanging out over here. This oxygen, this is a positive. Electrons kick back in and kick out the chloride. As the chloride gets kicked out, the chloride is going to serve as a base, which is going to deprotonate the proton here. And now we're set up to go through and do the oxidation. Now another base in solution pulls a proton, electrons move in, electrons move onto the chromium, and we get the oxidation that occurs. And we've had an equivalent of acid that comes out through there. So the mechanism for the way that the pyridinium chlorochromate works is very similar to the mechanism that the chromic acid was working before. And it's still the pulling of the proton, this step here, where we're pulling this proton, shifting electrons in, and then clipping of the bond. So we can even do it this way, that this bond is breaking and the electrons are going with the chromium. This bond is breaking and those electrons are going in to make the double bond. And that allows for our oxidation. Now, the way that the chromium reagent is made is to take and support it on silica gel. So what you literally do is take a mortar and pestle and we put in the chromic, put in the PCC plus silica gel. And then with a mortar and pestle, we grind this thing all up to make a supported reagent. The problem with this is, and then we take that reagent and we throw it into an Erlenmeyer flask with a little bit of solvent. So the supported reagent goes in. And then we use a solvent that goes in here as well, and a spin vane, and a little bit of solvent, and we just stir it for about 30 minutes until the reaction is complete, and we observe the color change as the reaction takes place. But in the process of doing this, everything is being contaminated with hexavalent chromium. So while you're grinding this up, and you're trying not to get chromium everywhere, and you're trying not to spill it around the lab, you're getting chromium on all the glassware, you're getting chromium onto the mortar and pestles, chromium winds up spilling around the lab as everybody's trying to work with it, and it just seems like a large source of unnecessary contamination within the lab. And so I tend to lean towards not doing it with the pyridinium chlorochromate. We do have a reagent that neutralizes it, but still I'm get concerned that we never get all of it. So one of the ways that we deal with this in the cleanup process, and we'll talk about this in more detail a little bit later, but if we look at that chromium in the hexavalent state, if you react it with sodium hydrogen sulfite, or sodium bisulfite, it reduces the chromium down to the chromium 3+. So while this one is carcinogenic, this is less toxic. And so what we do is we make that sodium bisulfite solution and we rinse everything with that sodium bisulfite solution. So we rinse all of the supported reagent after the oxidation is done to make sure that all of that reagent has been converted into its plus three state. We also rinse the mortar and pestles. Everything gets rinsed with that solution, trying to reduce the chromium to make it not so dangerous. But what that doesn't get and doesn't touch is anything that you guys would have spilled around the lab or around the fume hoods, which means that all of that stuff is just persistent dust that builds up in the lab. And over time, I was concerned about how much buildup there would be of that and the health effects that would be related to that of working in that lab day in and day out. So what I want to look at is another oxidation and to show you guys a different way of doing this. And this was the way that Pavia had set this up to begin with. So Pavia originally had a different oxidation scheme. The oxidation scheme used bleach. And they completely got rid of this in later versions, so they never even gave you the option. They just completely nixed it. Yeah, Kylie, you're glad you're online for this one. The bleach oxidation was actually a whole lot safer and a lot better. Not as high a yield, but did a pretty good job. So in this reaction, what we do is we set up with the racemic borneol and we use 0.360 grams of that isoborneol. We use a sodium hypochlorite solution. It's an aqueous sodium hypochlorite, NaOCl. So this is just bleach. This is aqueous. And it's generally between 10 and 15%. When you buy bleach at the store, the bleach that you buy at the store is 5%. So this is twice as concentrated as a bleach solution that you would use as a laundry detergent type of bleach. So it's quite a bit more concentrated. We use 6 milliliters of this. And this is going in with acetone and glacial acetic acid. So this is acetic acid. And I should put the term in there that this is glacial. Glacial means no water. Where do we need to do abbreviations? Let's do it down here. So there's two terms that we use. A chemical reaction, when a chemical reaction is done neat, it means in the absence of solvent or the absence of water. Glacial also for acetic acid. And I don't know where that term glacial comes from in terms of acetic acid, but glacial also means in the absence of water. So this is not an acetic acid solution. It is pure acetic acid that we are using in this. And then it's done at 45 degrees C for how long? 35 minutes. And then there's a fairly extensive workup. And I like this, I think, because of the workup in part, that it does a pretty good job and that there's quite a bit that we need to understand in terms of the way that this chemical reaction goes forward. But the way that the sodium hypochlorite does the oxidation is very similar to the way the chromic acid did the oxidation. There's just no chromium in the process. So what happens here is that it is the chlorine and the hypochlorite ion, which is the oxidizing agent. And so what winds up being formed is this. And there are, the sodium hypochlorite itself is a base within solution, but a base winds up pulling the proton. As the proton gets pulled, electrons move in and kick out the chlorine as the leaving group. And so what happens in this is the chloride ion is the leaving group. And we wind up getting a byproduct out of this, which is just chloride ion, which seems a whole lot better to me than dealing with hexavalent chromium and that whole process. So while this requires a slightly longer workup, at least it's not carcinogenic in the way that the chemical reaction actually progresses. So that's why I like this reaction a little bit better. So this is the reaction that we're going to set up. And I want to sort of walk through the reaction setup, what it's going to look like, and then the entire workup, and go through the workup fairly quickly. And then we'll look at the other reaction. I think we'll save the other reaction for Monday. We'll see where we get, because this is a fairly lengthy process. And we can compare it to the PCC one and look at how that process would have worked in a little bit more detail. Okay, so in order to set this up, we do this reaction generally in the 5-mil conical vial is what we typically do it in. And we set up in the fume hood, we do this in the fume hood because of the strong bleach solution. And if you do it out on the benchtops, which we could do it out on the benchtops, the entire room just smells very strongly of bleach by the time we get all the students working on it. So doing it in the fume hood prohibits that, makes that a whole lot better. So what we do is we set up in the fume hood a water bath. And we set it up in a beaker with just a small amount of water and the hot plate. And we get this thing heated up to somewhere around 45 degrees, but it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be within plus or minus like 10 degrees. And so this whole thing gets set up, and we do this on a jack stand as well. So a little rougher sketch than what I normally do. You guys get the idea. And in this, we're also going to have a ring stand that is going to be oriented towards the back of the fume hood so that the jack stand can be up against it. And we're going to put a clamp out in here. And we're going to set up the air condenser onto the 5-mil conical vial. And in that 5-mil conical vial, we're going to put a spin vane. And this whole thing gets clamped in place. And like I said, we're shooting for 45 degrees, plus or minus 10. Let's say plus or minus 5 degrees C. So we're somewhere between 40 and 50 degrees Celsius as we're setting this up. And what we do is we add 0.360 grams of the plus minus borneol. To the 5-mil conical vial. And then we add in 1 milliliter. Of acetone. And 0.3 milliliters. Of glacial acetic acid. And then we heat this thing until the borneol dissolves. If the borneol does not dissolve, then you can add another 0.5 milliliter of acetone if you need to. So that's just to get it to dissolve so that the whole thing becomes homogeneous. So that's only if needed. Okay, once that's all in place, then what we do is we add 6 milliliters of the sodium hypochlorite solution and the OCl. over a process of 35 minutes. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to add this in sort of half mil increments and add it slowly. We don't want to just dump in the sodium hypochlorite. And the sodium hypochlorite is an aqueous solution. Like we said, it's only 10 to 15% sodium hypochlorite. And so what happens is the glacial acetic acid and the acetone, the system starts to go biphasic as you're adding this. And if you dump it all in right away, then the system goes biphasic immediately and the reaction doesn't work so well. So we add the sodium hypochlorite slowly over time, over the 35 minutes, allowing the reaction to go biphasic in that process with fast stirring such that you get a lot of efficient mixing within the system, because the reaction is going to happen at the interface. And so the more efficient mixing that we can get, the better the reaction goes forward. So we add over 35 minutes with strong stirring. And like I said, the reaction is going to go biphasic. And biphasic just means that we have two phases. We have two layers. We have an aqueous layer and we have an organic layer, and the aqueous and the organic layer are separating with the aqueous layer on top. And once we reach those 35 minutes, then we consider that the reaction is mostly complete, and we cool the reaction to room temperature. So we just lower the jack stand. And cool to room temperature. Once we get it to room temperature, then we're going to move all of the contents into a centrifuge tube. So now the reaction is over and we start the workup process. In the workup process, we move into a centrifuge tube. And we're going to do a series of extractions and washes on the material. So once we get it into the centrifuge tube, then what we do is we extract twice, two times, with 2 milliliters of methylene chloride. So essentially what we're doing is we have 2 milliliters of methylene chloride, which find the bottom layer. And we have up in here, we have the aqueous with all of the acids. So we have acetic acid that is in there. There is chloride ions that are in there. There is our oxidized borneol that is in there, which is now, this is called camphor. In its oxidized state is the molecule camphor. So the camphor is in there. We also have some acetone that is in there. There's all these other reagents that are all in there. And we're going to cap this thing, shake and vent and extract twice with methylene chloride. And so what we do is when we say extract, that extract means shake, vent, and pull out organic layer. So that is the bottom layer that we're pulling out. And we're going to separate that bottom layer into a an Erlenmeyer flask, essentially. So we'll take out that bottom layer, and the bottom layer goes into here, and this will be our methylene chloride extraction. So we do that twice. That's times two. Is there a question? Our mic just got activated. All right. So once we go through and do that extraction, then what we do is we get rid of the aqueous layer. So we dispose of the aqueous layer. And put the organic layer, put the methylene chloride extraction back into the centrifuge tube. And what we're going to do is we're going to clean up the methylene chloride layer. So we're going to perform a series of washes on the methylene chloride layer in order to neutralize all the different things that are in it and extract all the different things from it. So one of the first things that we do, now that we have the methylene chloride layer back inside there, is we wash the methylene chloride, CH2Cl2, with 2 milliliters of saturated sodium bicarbonate. Then we shake and vent. So this is like an extraction, only we're calling it a wash. So we shake, vent, and pull out the methylene chloride. You're always extracting the bottom layer, and the methylene chloride is always the bottom layer in this process. So we want to get the methylene chloride out of this, and then we're going to dispose of the aqueous and put the methylene chloride back in. So each time we're pulling the methylene chloride out, getting rid of the aqueous portion, and then putting the methylene chloride back into the centrifuge tube in order to extract again. So we wash it with sodium bicarbonate. Then we wash the methylene chloride with 2 milliliters of 5% sodium hydrogen sulfite. That is a reducing agent, and that reducing agent is to neutralize any remaining bleach that may have found its way into the sodium hypochlorite. Again, this is an extraction. We're doing the shake, the vent, and pull the bottom layer. Then what we do is we wash the CH2Cl2 with water. And again, this is the shake and vent and that whole thing. And then what we're going to do is we're going to dry the methylene chloride layer with mag sulfate, just as we've done before. We'll tear around bottom. And we'll rotovap. Once we rotovap off all the methylene chloride, then you're going to get your mass. From that, you'll be able to get your percent yield. We'll take a melting point. The melting point on the borneol, the expected melting point is 174 degrees Celsius. And we'll also get an IR to show that we've actually oxidized that material. So we go through and do all of those different things. Let's take all of these different washes that we just did and show in a separation scheme where everything is going and how we're separating everything out of this. So let's, because it's so complicated, I think a separation scheme is a good idea to go through here. So when the chemical reaction is over, what we've got in the chemical reaction is everything that we put into it. We can list out all our different solvents. We have water. We have acetic acid that we added into that. We have acetone that was a component of that. There is probably some sodium hypochlorite left, NaOCl, is still hanging out in there. There is HCl that has been produced in the process of the oxidation. We also have in there the thing that we started with, our starting material, which was the plus minus borneol. And then we have the camphor that we've made. I can't get the angles right for some reason. There we go. So there's our camphor. So all of these things are all in solution together. And what we do is we add into this methylene chloride, CH2Cl2, and we split it up into an organic layer and an aqueous layer. And we're doing this times two. So we would repeat this process times two. In the aqueous layer is going to wind up all of the acids. So we're going to get some water. We're going to get the acetic acid, which is going to come over into here. Most of the sodium hypochlorite, NaOCl, should be over here, as should the HCl. And then in the organic, we're going to get the methylene chloride, CH2Cl2. We're going to get the probably a little bit of acetone that is going to come over here as well. Acetone is probably going to end up in both places. It'll be split between the two. And we'll get our two materials. Which is the borneol and the camphor. And also along this way, it's possible that we could get a little bit of sodium hypochlorite that can come over here. And you would say, well, that's really water soluble. That shouldn't end up over here. But you would be surprised what does end up here. And it's possible that I could get some acetic acid, because the acetic acid, while water soluble, can also dissolve into methylene chloride. And so the series of washes that are designed to deal with this. Number one, we use the saturated sodium bicarbonate, NaHCO3. The NaHCO3, the sodium bicarbonate, breaks things up into three different layers. We get the organic layer, we get an aqueous layer, and we get a gas that comes off of this too. The gas that comes off is carbon dioxide. So we have to be careful that when we add the sodium bicarbonate, that we actually don't put the lid on right away, but to stir it with a spatula to some degree and to swirl it to allow for all of the evolution of CO2 that we can visibly see before we cap it, so that we don't create a bomb, because the amount of pressure that can build up when you shake and vent, if you don't vent it fast enough, it can build up a lot of CO2 from the acetic acid that it's reacting with in there. So in the aqueous layer, we're getting water, we're getting sodium salts that are coming out of this. This is going to be the sodium acetate. If there was HCl in there, we might end up with a little bit of sodium chloride that's going to come out into the water. Any remaining unreacted sodium bicarbonate is going to go that direction. And now, so what we can do is we can say that this reagent, the sodium bicarbonate that we are using, is really meant to deal with the acid component and is meant to extract that acid component or neutralize that acid component. And then we still have the remaining things here that are ending up as our organic component. Less now. The acids. The next wash that we did is to take and wash this with sodium bisulfite, 5% sodium bisulfite. So we take this guy, and I'm going to sort of migrate it over here, and we add into it sodium bisulfite, 5% NaHSO3, and this is an aqueous reagent. Here we end up with the organic and the aqueous as well. And because I'm splitting across two pages of notes, when I make a PDF, it's going to be ugly. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this piece and drop it down here. And let's copy this so it doesn't look so ugly when we look at it as a PDF. And actually, that will allow me to just do this straight so I can clean this up too. Okay, so we add in the next step, which is the sodium bisulfite wash. The sodium bisulfite wash, the purpose of this one is to get rid of any sodium hypochlorite. It's a reducing agent. And so it's going to react with the oxidizing agent and completely reduce that so that what we end up with is water, probably sodium chloride, and any remaining sodium hydrogen sulfite, because we're using it in an excess over there, is going to end up in that place. And what I'll be left with now is this guy. From here, we do the water wash. And the water wash is just in case there's any salts that are left over. These salts may be any sodium hydrogen carbonate. They may be any sodium bisulfite that could be remaining that might still be over here as impurities. This next step of washing with water is really one just to get rid of the salts. And so I'm going to put my aqueous on this side so I can get more central. That's going to bring in my water and my salts and my organic, which is now going to be just my solvents. The next thing that I do to this is I dry it with mag sulfate. So we take this guy. Oh, it's amazing how many pages you go through when you do a big separation scheme like this. I think I've already got that in memory. So we take this guy, which now has some water in it from the water wash that we just did and all of the water washes that we just did. So we dry it with magnesium sulfate, MgSO4, and we get the solid, which is MgSO4.7H2O. So that's our heptahydrate and our liquid layer. Our liquid layer has all of these components still in it. Then we're going to rotovap that. So we add in heat and we rotovap, we get a gas, which is going to be the acetone and the methylene chloride. And then we're going to get solid. And the solid is going to be the camphor and the borneol. And in terms of getting the camphor and the borneol, we're hoping that this is really major and that this is acting as an impurity. And camphor actually has the unique ability that we can sublime it. So we can, if we need to, if we do the IR and we do the melting point and they don't come out clean enough and they show that they are, that they have a large amount of the impurity in them, then we can go through and we can do a further step if we need to. We can go through and do a sublimation in order to purify the camphor. And it is the exact same sublimation that we did for the caffeine. So we would use the same apparatus as we did for caffeine to go through and do the sublimation. And so we can say, if needed, we can do one more step here, and that is we heat, and this would be the sublimation. And we get a gas going back to a solid, and we get the solid over here, that does not go through sublimation, and we can separate out the two components if we need to. Most of the time it comes out clean enough that when we check it by the melting point and we check it by our IR, that we don't really need to go through and do that sublimation. So the sublimation is just sort of an extra step if we need it. Let's take a look at the IRs, or let me ask, I mean, that was a long separation scheme that had all those different washes in it. But I think that in looking at them and seeing how the sodium bicarbonate is removing acids, the sodium bisulfite is removing oxidizing agent, the water is removing any remaining salts. So here, the water is really pulling out these salts. And then the magnesium sulfate is removing the water. And then as we go through and use the heat is removing each one of the solvents in order to evaporate the solvents. You can kind of see how the separation scheme works. And this is also why it's really important to understand separation schemes, because when you're developing a procedure like this with all these different washes, you want to make sure, how do you design that? How do you know what it is that you're actually doing? Well, each one of these washes is designed to pull out a specific component. And unless you can sit down and draw out the separation scheme and envision sort of what it is that you're trying to do, it's very difficult to develop a process like this. It's also much easier to understand, why you're doing each one of these washes. And so that when you're working in the lab and you're actually going through and doing the manipulations, if you can visualize in your mind what it is you're trying to achieve, or if you have the separation scheme right there so that you can see what it is you're trying to achieve, it makes the process much less confusing and much less of a recipe. And instead, you're doing it with focus and intent on removing each component and going through the separation. So that's kind of the way that I like you guys to try to think about it in that way. Let me see if I can pull the IRs. And I hadn't really thought about doing this ahead of time, which was a mistake on my part, but let me grab them. And so let's get the borneol first. Get the IR. And let's get a KBR disc. And then I can airdrop that. All right. So this is the borneol. What do you notice about the borneol in terms of? This would be the starting material. So remember that this is our starting material. What functional group do you see that's present immediately that is consistent with this material? What are we looking for in the IR?
The hydroxyl group.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. It's the hydroxyl group that's in there. So the hydroxyl group is the group that is right here. This is our OH. The hydroxyl group. The carbon-hydrogen stretches are here. And then the rest of this is really fingerprint. So if we're looking at the transformation and we're looking at going from Borneo to camphor, what do we expect to see in the next IR? Or what do we not expect to see? Sorry, I'm pulling up the next one here. Got it. All right, here's the next one. So this is the camphor. This is our product. And what we see is we see the loss of the hydroxyl. So whereas we had the hydroxyl in the other one, there's no hydroxyl in this one. And what we get here is the carbonyl. So this one, the carbonyl is showing up at 1744. And so we have the loss of the hydroxyl, and we have the new carbonyl in the oxidation. And so what we're looking for is that when we do the IR, we're looking to make sure that we don't have that hydroxyl peak, that the hydroxyl is really gone. And we're also looking for the fact that we have the carbonyl. Now, if we had something that had some hydroxyl character to it and maybe had a shorter carbonyl, then we would know that we had a mixture of products and that we might need to go through and do the sublimation. That would also be evident in the melting point, where the melting point would be lowered and be broader as well. So that's another thing that we would look for in the correlation between the melting points. And so that's how we would analyze the product, and that's what we would be looking for in the product itself. Let's see, what else do I need to tell you guys? So that would be the first part of the experiment, and that would occupy the first day. In the second day, we would look at going through and doing the reduction. And so that would be the end of the first day. And the second day, which we'll do on Monday, we would go through and do the reduction. And the reduction uses sodium borohydride. And if you remember, we used sodium borohydride before. We used it when we did the chromatography lab, and it was tracking the chemical reaction in the chromatography lab. So in the chromatography lab, what we had was fluorinone. That was reduced by sodium borohydride to make fluorinol. And this started out yellow and went to colorless. And we talked a little bit about the mechanism of sodium borohydride and how the borohydride is tetrahedral in nature, and each one of the hydrogens is partially negative and therefore can be transmitted as a hydride reagent. So we'll go through and we'll look at that hydride on Monday and look at that reaction and that separation scheme and how we work that one all up as well. And then we'll look at the sterics and how the sterics interacted and how we would have analyzed those products, because now what we're looking for is we're looking for the ratio of two products, and we would have gone back to using the GCs and injected these into the GCs to look for the ratios of the borneol to isoborneol, and then compared those ratios out of the GCs to understand how this reaction takes place. So I think that's what I'm going to reserve until Monday, and we'll come back and talk about that piece on Monday. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else to really talk about in terms of this chemical reaction. And I don't think so. I think we've sort of covered it. Unless you guys have any sort of questions that you want me to address about chemistry or anything. No? I'm looking back to find my screen that's got pictures of everybody so I can see how everybody's doing. There we go. I need a third monitor. Two monitors is not sufficient. I have too many windows open. All right, so we've learned a little bit about oxidizing agents. We've learned a little bit more on separation schemes and had a slightly more complicated separation scheme that we've looked at, and learned some new chemistry today. That's gonna help us later going on in the lecture portion of the class when we get into oxidizing agents, which is where we go after we get through the SN1, SN2, E1, E2, is we start getting into alcohols and we look at oxidizing reagents, and we'll talk more about Jones reagent and pyridinium chlorochromate. And there's another one that's called pyridinium dichromate. There's Swern oxidation. There's a number of different oxidations, and it's an area that we spend a bit of time in looking at. And so, so this just helps us along and makes that all look a little bit more familiar when we get to that spot in lecture as well. Okay, so if there aren't any other questions, I suggest that we adjourn and we'll pick it up back in lecture. How does that sound? Okay, so we'll get a slightly longer break today. We'll pick it up in about an hour and meet back. And Dina, I saw you there. Dina, I owed you an email. Maybe if you want to stay on the line, maybe you and I can chat for a minute once everybody takes off. How does that sound? Okay, awesome.
Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome, you guys. I'll see you at 11:10.